This is episode number 22 of Build and Analyze. This is a weekly news and discussion show. We cover things like the iPhone, sure, the iPad, why not? iOS in general. Sometimes we talk about Android, coffee, and whatever else Marco Arment, the creator of Instapaper, is fond of talking about. I'm Dan Benjamin, and we'd like to quickly say thanks to CampaignMonitor.com and Intuit, specifically the new small business blog over at Intuit, which we'll tell you about more as the show goes on. Hey, Marco, what's going on?
Not too much. How are you?
I'm doing well. I can't really complain. Did you have a lovely holiday over the weekend here, the Easter holiday? Is that something you partake of?
Yeah, it was nice. Yeah, I actually I got to give someone coffee that I roasted as a gift for the first time ever, so there was a little bit of pressure on myself from that, but it worked out well. I even discovered that the vent fan on my, like, I've been roasting because roasting generates a lot of smoke. I've been doing it under the vent hood on my stove.
Does that vent out, just, or does it just vent into your kitchen?
You know, I don't really know for sure. We haven't quite figured that out yet. I think it vents out, but I've never seen the vent on the roof or anything. I have no idea where the vent is. I haven't been able to find it, so I don't know. But I also can't feel the air coming out from anywhere, and it's kind of hard to see where the duct goes past the cabinet. So I have no idea. But anyway, I discovered instead that I could put the roaster next to a window with a box fan sitting on the windowsill blowing out. I love box fans; they're the best kind of fans. And especially there's an Air King model, I think 7237. There's an Air King box fan that I love. That I had one, like, my mom got it from her school classroom from forever ago, and I had that one forever. And then I got a second one because they're so good. They're like the best box fans ever. None of these like little, you know, cheapo Kmart ones. But box fan blowing out of a window pushes a lot of air. And it ends up that's much, much more exhaust power than the little vent hood on my, even though it's actually a pretty sizable vent hood, but far more power than that. Mm. And so I'm able to roast now without filling the whole downstairs of the house with the smell of roasting smoke, which is a big benefit to avoid that. So getting better. I'm very happy about that. Speaking of coffee, got a nice question from David Smith this week. We've previously recommended both the AeroPress, which I love, which is all I ever brew coffee with, and the Contigo coffee mug. It's a fantastic travel mug, and it's awesome. And he said, what do you do about this? Because the AeroPress, you can't brew directly into the Contigo mug because it doesn't, you know, the top doesn't fit on the mug. The mug is a little bit too small.
Right.
Well, it turns out the AeroPress comes with a bunch of little plastic things. It doesn't really explain what they are. One of them looks like a funnel. And the idea is that you stick this funnel thing on top of the AeroPress when you're dumping the coffee grounds into it, so that it kind of funnels them all into it so you don't get it all over your hands. But the top of it is shaped like a hexagon, like the base of the AeroPress. And so what you can do is you can use it also as a funnel from the AeroPress to the cup. You stick the AeroPress on top of it and, you know, push into it. And the bottom of the funnel is smaller than the base of the AeroPress. So you can use that to press into things that have a smaller opening than the AeroPress's base, okay, like the Contigo mug. And it ends up that it fits perfectly in the Contigo. So it is indeed possible to brew directly into the Contigo mug. You just use the little funnel thing that the AeroPress comes with, and that's it. I'm sure this is very useful to you.
Well, Keurig is working fine for me.
Oh, that's...
You know, it's funny because, yeah, I was thinking, you're about 10 years younger than me.
Something like that.
And as I've said to you in email when we were discussing this, I said, you're far more successful at 28 or thereabouts than I was at 28. And arguably, you're incredibly successful by any measure at any age. But I was thinking back to 10 years ago, and I was thinking, you know, that's when I had the similar car to yours. That's when I was like super into coffee. I also had cigars in the mix back then. I would, you know, detailed logs of all the cigars in my little JFK cigar notebook, and was very much on the same page as you back then. I think we would have enjoyed hanging out and talking about those kinds of things. I'm not saying that you will de-evolve into the state that I'm in now, where you don't care about those things anymore. But it reminded me. You remember how you were talking about your car, and you were saying,
"Of course,
when you drive, you want to feel something. You don't just want to get there. You want to have an experience when you drive.
Right. Like I want to have a car that I love, not necessarily just the most practical thing or the most economical thing.
Right. So I remember when I was shopping cars, around the time I bought this equivalent car to what you have now or similar, a buddy of mine went with me on one of those trips. And at the time, he already had a small family of his own, you know, his wife, and he had a brand new kid. And I was talking to him about the different cars. I was saying, you know, what do you think about these others? This one, there's this one. He's like, Dan, I don't even have a frame of reference. For me, the car that I have is simply about functionality and safety. And I remember thinking, this man is dead inside. You know, jokingly.
Well, you know, it isn't about thinking less of people who, similar to what you've said, like a lot of people don't care about coffee as much as I do. In fact, almost everyone doesn't care about coffee as much as I do. It isn't that I think badly of people who don't care about the same things I do, but I do kind of feel sorry for people who don't care about anything this much. That, to me, is the bigger tragedy. If you, like, there are things, Dan, that you care about a lot.
That's true.
And I respect that, even though you don't care about coffee as much as I do and you drink the crap from the canister, and even though, or the, you know, the little cartridge things that everyone thinks are high end because it comes in a nice looking silver machine. this is just terrible, by the way.
It's fast.
Right. It's convenient. So is McDonald's. You know, the most convenient meal is McDonald's. But if you don't care about what you're eating, or if you're in a situation where you don't have time to care, that's an option.
A lot of people don't care
about coffee.
I used to spend $350 on a tire when I was getting those tires. And they would only last like 30,000 miles. That was my biggest complaint about that car, but I liked everything else.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's about what you care about. And as I said, like, I would much rather, I don't care if you don't care about everything that I like, that's fine with me. I just want everyone to care about something. And if, you know, obviously there's not much I can do if you don't, but
I like that. You want somebody to have the same kind of passion that you feel in this case about multiple things.
Even if it's more spread out, like even if they're not really a super geek about anything, I just think it's sad when people seem to have no passion in life. Like they go to their mediocre job that they don't really like, but it pays the bills. And they don't spend money on anything fun because they need to be saving it. And then they come home and they watch TV, and they don't even watch good TV shows. They kind of just watch whatever's on, you know. And then they drink their Bud Light and they go to sleep. That, to me, that's a very sad existence. And you know, even if nothing about it to them seems bad in particular, it seems like it's fairly joyless. And you know, when you have passion, when you care about something, it's a source of joy, usually, or at least it can be. And it's just very sad when people don't have that. And so, yeah, it doesn't matter what your source of joy is. You just need to have something. You know? And I think if you don't have anything, I don't know, you probably aren't listening to this show, first of all. You're probably not using computers very much.
I think you touch on an interesting topic. I think that there are a lot of developers, especially, who enjoy... And, you know, they may not care about coffee in particular, but they enjoy the approach that you take and the philosophy that you have when it comes to the focus on quality. Quality in the sense of like the Persig concept of quality, which, for those who haven't read Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, it's a good book.
I have started that book like four times.
It's a great book. You just got to get through the first quarter of it's tough. From there, it really opens up once he starts talking about the Chautauqua and things like that.
Like the first two episodes of The Wire.
Never seen it.
Never saw The Wire?
No.
What is with... Oh, my God.
I don't watch much TV.
Right. You gotta watch only what's good. Trust me, you got to watch The Wire. The only thing is it builds a giant story arc from the very beginning. And this is one of the reasons why it didn't do so well when it was actually on TV. It did okay, but you know, not great. It builds a tremendous story arc. It's like watching one long movie. As a result... The first couple episodes are very, very slow because they're really setting up a lot of stuff. And if you go back and watch it again after you're done with the series, if you rewatch it,
yeah,
first of all, there's a lot of value in rewatching it because you'll pick up a lot more. But when you rewatch it, the slowness of the first couple episodes is fully understandable. And you can tell, oh, of course, that's why they did it that way. That makes a lot of sense. Mm. But when you're watching it for the first time, you watch the first episode or two of almost every season. Almost every season begins with a slow episode. And you think, oh, this is boring. This is going to be a slow show. But it's really fantastic.
Was it violent? Pretty violent?
Extremely. Yeah, you can't watch it with a kid or anything. But
yeah, I don't think I can watch it at all.
But it's extremely good. It's a fantastic social commentary. It has, you know, great writing, great cinematography. It's just really, really good.
You know what I did see over the weekend? That new Tron, that new Tron movie. I saw that.
I should probably watch the old one before commenting.
I don't know.
I've never seen any of them.
Eye candy.
Is this the second one or the third one?
The second one. Is there a third?
I don't know. You would know.
I think there's a second.
I got a question from Gordon Fontenot. I don't know. On interface builder versus building interfaces natively with code.
Right.
So have you ever done either of these things? Well, I know you don't like Objective-C because of the brackets being ugly.
Yeah, I can't abide those.
Which, that's fine.
But I have written apps in Objective-C. I have built Cocoa applications, not many and not well, but I have. And I've definitely done in the old days before there were beautiful, amazing things like Project Builder or Xcode. I have done, you know, creating a graphical interface with just lines of code, which today seems like an impossible way to do it. But my understanding is you still have to do that sometimes.
You don't have to, but a lot of times it's a lot easier to. And so I think, you know, when you're choosing whether to build the interface with code or with Interface Builder, one of the big questions is how many elements does it have? I mean, in my case, I built all of Instapaper up through version 2.0 with just code. And then from version 2.1 on, I started using Interface Builder for some things.
Do you think that's typical? Is that
Well, part of it was just practical. When I started coding it, Interface Builder wasn't yet available for the iOS SDK, which at the time was called the iPhone SDK. It wasn't available for the first few versions of the SDK.
Right.
And then they added it later. So I just started without it, and I kind of prefer the bare metal approach to things, you know, in general. Most of the time, if given that option, I'll take the bare metal approach. And also Interface Builder, the way it was designed with various, you know, linking up the outlets and the actions and everything, it was not very intuitive. And I haven't used it in Xcode 4 yet enough to say whether they've improved that very much. Because I haven't yet built a new interface in Xcode 4. I've only been editing existing ones. But from what I can tell, it's not that much simpler, but I don't know yet. It's unintuitive. Interface Builder is very unintuitive. But when you have an interface with more than a handful of elements, it's pretty nice to have. And so, you know, on the iPhone, it wasn't that big of a deal because most of my iPhone interfaces were just one giant view. Like the navigation control, you don't have to build. That's all built for you.
Right.
Although, God, I fight that so much. I fight you on navigation controller. You know, the navigation controls are built for you, so you basically just have to give it the views for the entire content area. And on the iPhone, that's often just one view. It's a table view, or it's a web view, or it's a giant, you know, image or something. It's usually just one big view, maybe with a toolbar or something, but usually not much else. So if that's the case, it really isn't that difficult to just build it yourself in code, and then you know every single thing that happens. On the plus side, Interface Builder is still fast and easy, even if you're only doing one view. So if you're already accustomed to Interface Builder, it's pretty easy to do anything with it, to just use it for everything. There is one big downside to it, though, which is localized strings. And I really shouldn't speak too much about this because I haven't done it directly, so I don't know fully. But From what I've been told, from what I understand, if you want to localize your app, you do yourself a huge disservice by putting any text strings in the Interface Builder nib file, or zib now, I guess. Because when you localize that, what it does is it creates a bunch of alternate versions of itself for each language. Then the problem is if you want to like move an interface element or add one, you have to go do that in every single language that you've deployed to. Like because they're all different files. Like there's copies of the file with different strings in them. So as far as I – and again, I'm sorry if this is totally wrong. This is what I've been, this is what I was told like a year and a half ago that this is how it worked. So if that's the case, you would do yourself a huge disservice by putting anything, any strings in there for localization. But you can still have a hybrid approach. So you can say – you can make everything in the nib file and then just do – just insert the strings on load from code from a localized string process. So that way you could – just have like the big strings file and that sort of thing. But again, this is way beyond my expertise, so I should probably stop there. But yeah, for the most part, Interface Builder, once you learn it and once you learn things like the various object ownership cycles and how to not leak all the outlets that it gives you, once you figure all that stuff out and get a feel for it, it's fine. And so while I used to build everything manually, now I only build the simplest views manually. So again, if it's the kind of thing where it has one big view in the controller and that's it, then I'll still do that programmatically. But if it has much of anything else, I'll do it with Interface Builder because it's easier and a little bit faster. And again, with the iPhone, I think the one big view is more common. With the iPad, it's not so much. With the iPad, you're much more likely to need a lot more things on screen at once, just a lot more elements. Even if they're, you know, small and well designed, it's still unlikely to be just one big view. By the way, in my own app, I hate the list view on the iPad. I just hate it. I'm trying to figure out what to do with it, and I've been experimenting, but I really, really hate it. I think the big table view of a giant list on the iPad looks ridiculous. Is there an app that does that well?
Mm. Not, you know? I mean, nothing that jumps out to me.
I have never seen one that I liked. I do like, I've been playing with, I guess I'll give it away, who cares? My competitors are going to rip me off regardless.
You're going to like do a reveal here?
I haven't decided what to do yet. I was playing with a kind of Flipboard style, just like two columns of squarish cells.
Mm.
So you'd have you'd have multi-line headline and then, you know, multi-line summary. The problem with any of these things, most of these things are made in contexts where the list of articles is fairly static, or at least like when you launch the app, it downloads the new articles and that's it. But with Instapaper, you have to be able to delete them, and then they animate out from that list, and you got to figure out what to do with that action. You know, do you reload the whole thing and make the whole view, you know, blink, and then that's kind of bad, or do you actually try to animate that, and then how do you animate that when you have two rows? That's more difficult, and then. A very commonly requested feature is the ability to reorder articles. And so if you're going to be reordering these things, you can't have those two columns. That would be horrible.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you could attempt it, but it would be a very bad experience. And so it would also be really difficult to program that. So basically, if I did that, I would be losing a lot of the built-in functionality of UI Table View. Because I think I probably wouldn't even be able to use UI Table View anymore. If not, I'd at least have to use a ton of hacks, which I'd rather not do. So I don't know what to do with that list yet. I think, and this is, I mean, the reason I'm talking about this in particular is because I think this could be useful for a lot of different apps. One thing I like a lot is the official Twitter app for iPad. When it first came out, I wasn't crazy about the interface because it was new and confusing.
Hmm.
But now that I'm used to it, and they've also made improvements on it. I like it a lot. And I think it helps that it, because Twitter is one big list. You know, the Twitter interface is just going to be a big list view regardless of what you do with it. I like what, I'm pretty sure it's Lauren Brichter's work. I like what he's done with the iPad version of Twitter because he has these lists, but they're managed in such a way that none of them are ever so ridiculously wide that they take up the whole iPad screen because that's terrible.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, you know, he maintains the hierarchy and it all works. And, you know, the sliding stuff I still get confused by a little bit. Like sometimes it doesn't do what I want it to do. But for the most part, I think he's found a really good balance of how to make long lists work in an iPad app visually and graphically. And I have not yet found that balance in the context of Instapaper's article list view. So I'll see. I still don't know what I'm going to do yet. And I might just leave it mostly the way it is because I can't yet find anything better. But I don't know. I'll see.
How much do you feel like talking about this kind of thing openly? What potential changes, potential things you're going to do, what, you know, in relationship to what your competitors might be thinking about or listening to? And how much of that do you think really matters? Do you feel like if this is something that now there's like a race for you to get it out there? And because you kind of hinted at that jokingly, but how real is that concern? I mean, how,
that's a good question. We talked about it a little bit, like 5 or 6 episodes.
Yeah, and we never really got into it that much.
That's a really good question. The answer is I don't know. I really don't know how much this stuff matters. I'm less concerned about my existing competitors because they're all like known quantities. And like, you know, I know how they work. Mm. I know what they do well. I know what they don't do well. I know how I compare. And for the most part, I don't really feel threatened by any existing competitors. You know, one of the big things is this is a massive market. And I've always said, like, if I could get 1% of iOS device owners to install Instapaper, I'd be rich. I'd be so well set, you know, because how many devices do they have? Like 120 million or something at least? Probably more than that, probably 150 million. Who knows? It's a lot. So if I get 1% of those, I get like $6 million. I mean, it's crazy. So it's a big, that's a huge market, right? In fact, I can probably say this. I'm not part of the Mac developer program, so I don't have access to the Lion beta. And I've never seen it. I honestly have never seen it. I haven't installed it. I haven't gotten it through any other means. I don't have time to mess with that, to be honest. But from what I understand, the version of Safari in Lion has resources and a help file about a reading list view that sounds a lot like Instapaper, where you save things to your reading list and then you can read them with the Safari Reader text view.
Right.
Which is based on readability, and so it sounds a lot like Safari on Lion has its own seemingly self-contained version of a reading list where the feature hasn't actually been turned on yet, but all the resources and documentation are there for it. And so this is actually a really good topic as well, which is what happens when Apple invades your market. So you know, you look at things like that and things like competitive threats. Here's a quick aside. I'm going to be like Marlon and keep all my parentheses open. Sorry.
Sure.
I love that, by the way. You know, when Starbucks, I know we talk about coffee occasionally. So this is going to be an okay analogy to use.
Yeah.
Starbucks has a very, very strong history of extremely predatory location choosing. They will go, this is one of the reasons I don't like them very much, but the rest of the story will explain why it doesn't matter. Starbucks will really, they're very, very predatory in this regard. They will seek out other independent coffee shops and open up shop right next door to them or right across the street. And like, even if, you know, you can say, oh, well, maybe that's just the best market, the best place for a coffee shop. No. This is like really specific. Like they will go literally the building next door or right across the street from any other coffee shop. They're real, real dicks like that. So for a while, everyone was thinking Starbucks was going to kill all the independent coffee shops. And they really did put a lot of them out of business because a lot of them weren't very good. you know, not every mom and pop shop is good.
Right.
So a lot of them went out of business, but the good ones actually, in most cases, saw a boost in their sales. And the main reason why, there were two reasons. One is that Starbucks' popularity in general across the whole country and potentially the whole world, sorry, international viewers, I don't want to seem like this is a US-centric podcast. But Starbucks' popularity kind of awoke a demand in people for coffee. Before Starbucks got very popular, coffee was in the – we've talked about this – kind of in this dark age from like the 50s forward where everything was just about raw convenience and cheapness. You had the canned Folgers. You had instant coffee. You had all this terrible stuff. And so people stopped caring about coffee, and they, what they thought was coffee was terrible. And so Starbucks kind of awoke this demand in people for caring about coffee again and saying this is actually good. And so what that did was that caused people to seek out coffee where they weren't really doing it before. They now said, okay, now that I care about this again, you know, let me look around and look around at these coffee shops that have been mostly ignored for all these years. Let's see what's out there. So so secondly, by moving right across the street or right next to another coffee shop, Starbucks brought a lot of people there. So before, you know, the coffee is really, most of it is a to-go business. People get coffee to go. That's the bulk of the business. So now Starbucks was drawing a bunch of people who would drive by and recognize the Starbucks sign and say, oh, I know what this is. I can stop there for coffee.
Right.
They were making a bunch of people go to these places or get out of their cars or walk to these places on the street and know that's where they could get coffee. And then when the line at Starbucks got really long, they would say, oh, look, there's a coffee shop next door. Well, maybe I'll check that out. And so it drew customers to that particular area who wanted coffee, who were previously ignoring this little coffee shop because they didn't know it was there and they didn't know what the name meant and they had no idea. So it actually did them a huge favor. So going back now, the reason I brought this up is, you know, if Apple does indeed launch this reading list thing, which it looks like almost a sure thing, you know, is this going to be bad for me? And, you know, is it bad in general if Apple moves into your market? And I think overall, it definitely makes me a little uneasy. But I think overall it's going to be a good thing for many of the same reasons. So, you know, first, I think I don't – first of all, the way Apple does things is they tend to do the bare minimum of what's going to satisfy most people. And then we'll do that, and then we're not going to do anything extra. So there's always going to be the market of people seeking out features and kind of the pro version of things. So, you know, if Apple does this, even if they then in the future build in kind of the third pillar of what Instapaper does, which is the syncing across multiple devices, which I think if they don't have that, I'm really not worried about it. But I'm sure they'll build that in at some point. You know, if they're doing this in desktop Safari, it's only a matter of time before it syncs that reading list to your iPad and to your iPhone. Although Apple has shown so far that they don't do web services that well. So we'll see if they ever actually get to that. But let's say they even do that. So let's say it does all the main things that Instapaper does. I still think this is overall going to be probably not a bad thing for me and possibly a very good thing. And you can see, you know, the same kind of thing somebody mentioned this morning, same kind of thing with Brent Simmons and NetNewsWire when Apple introduced RSS support in Safari and Mail. So what that did was it showed a lot of people that this thing called RSS exists. But it didn't do a very good job with it. You know, it's like here's this thing called RSS and Safari and Mail each kind of support a kind of half-baked way to do it. And, you know, it'll show you what it is and it'll be okay for a lot of people. But if you're actually going to get into this thing, this is not going to be sufficient for you. You're going to want to seek out, you know, a real dedicated client. So that very well could happen to me too, where Apple could be building in this thing to the browser, which is kind of a, you know, an approximation of Instapaper's core functionality, but right. I'm guessing they're not going to do that much with it. I'm guessing it's going to be very simple, very limited, possibly even bad. Who knows? Well, you know, we'll see about that. But if that shows a lot of people, hey, this is going to be like this is a really cool thing. I love saving pages to read later, but this kind of sucks. Like this version of it is not quite enough. Then I can go to those people and I can say, hey, this is a pro version of what you're already using in Safari. This is the advanced version. So now they know this context. Like one of the problems I have, and as far as I know, all of my competitors have this problem, is that this solves a need that people have, but they don't know that they have it yet. You know, so the problem I have isn't in convincing people to buy my thing over my competitors' things. It's to convince people that that it's really to explain my problem, to say this is what I do, and you really will get a lot of value out of this, but you might not realize it yet. So that's the problem I have to solve, is getting people to know that they should seek this out. So if Apple is giving them this other version of it, especially if they promote it in the interface enough for people to actually use the thing, I don't know if they will, but you know, if they do, then that probably creates a pretty big market for me to say, here, you guys, you already know that you're doing this, you already know you like it, here's the next step. Come to Instapaper, and this is the advanced version, and here's what's better about it, rather than let me try to explain it from scratch what this whole thing does. Yeah, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I think it's a very interesting take on it. I mean, I like the idea of presenting the pro version. I like that you kind of brought up the whole, you know, the whole aspect of what about when Apple steps into this. I think it's the whole thing like an NDA. You know, you've heard people, experienced angel investors and VCs and things like that, say, oh, you know what, I don't sign an NDA. I mean, I've heard this time and time again, I won't sign an NDA. Tell me about it. And people are so worried that they've stumbled on, you know, this invention, this thing that is so remarkable that if just the idea gets out of the four walls of the room that they're in, you know, that they'll be ruined. And I'd love to hear your take on this. But
oh, I hate those people.
Well, I'd love to hear.
I get an email like once a week about that.
Do you really?
I have this great idea. I'd love to have you work on it, or give me some guidance.
But you
on
need
it.
To sign an NDA.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, come on, really? Look, ideas are worthless.
Yeah.
Your idea, someone's already had it. I hate to tell you, someone has had this idea before.
And that's because it's the execution and the implementation that's the challenging part. I mean, anybody could go and write an app. It might be good, it might not be good, but that's not the hard part. The hard part is putting it out there, continuing to keep it out there, maintaining it, making it better, surprising people with new features, doing things that people really want, being responsive. I mean, that's the hard part of it. Unless maybe you disagree, but in my experience, the code is not the hard part. You know, refining it and being there day after day after day for weeks, months, and years potentially, that's the hard part.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and there's this phenomenon throughout history where inventions are usually like, for a lot of major inventions, like three different people around the world will have come up with them at almost the same time. And then they all kind of rush and see who can patent it first or who can release it first. The reason why this happens is not because these three people just happen to have this exact same idea at the same time so frequently through magic. It's because ideas are built off of other ideas. And so, you know, this happens so much because at that point in history, most of the pieces were in place for this idea to exist, and all three of those guys put them together independently. They weren't stealing from each other. They just all they all had the same idea assembly from what was already there and from what was almost already in place. And that same thing happens in every industry. That's just you know, a fact of life. Your idea is not new. Maybe you haven't seen it done yet. Maybe it hasn't been done yet. But that's for different reasons in all likelihood. Chances are either someone has already done your idea and you just haven't found it, or no one else thought they could do your idea. Like if it's something that they didn't think was possible, but if you have a way to do it, that's kind of good.
Right.
Or your idea just might not be very good. And maybe everyone else hasn't done it because it's not worth doing.
Yeah.
You know, so all those things are definitely worth considering.
So let's do our first sponsor. Okay, this is a new one. This is something that's kind of cool. We're sponsored by the Intuit Small Business Blog this week. Now, these guys have been doing this for a while, but it's actually pretty cool. Here's the deal: if you run a small, medium-sized business, I think a lot of the people listening to this show probably would fit into that category. You need to check this site out. It's got really, really good, important articles that focus on things like the stuff we talk about here, from building apps, online marketing. They talk about starting a business, social media, and a whole lot more. And now it's gone mobile. So as of today, actually, I think it was maybe late last week, you can download the Intuit Small Business Blog as an iOS app. It works on your iPhone, iPod Touch, and iPad, and you can read the blog articles on the go. You can stay current with the latest stories. You can find the past shows, you can find the past stories by topic or text search. This is a really great app, really handy. I love to stay up to date with this because it lets me know what's going on in the community of other business people, not just in technology, but overall. They're coming out with an Android version of the app soon. But for now, you can go, you take it for a test drive, kick the tires, and let them know what you think. You can check it out at the Intuit Small Business blog, which is blog.intuit.com. Or you just search for Intuit Blog in the iTunes App Store. Do you follow along with any of this kind of thing, Mark, or do you just heads down writing code?
Heads down writing code.
Yeah.
This week I was improving the Instapaper bookmarklet, and I discovered a lot of new crazy stuff. So did you know about CORS? C-O-R-S?
It sounds familiar, but I'll say no. Let's say no. I'll go with
it's
no.
It's I think it's like a year and a half old now, but nobody really supported it until fairly recently on a large scale. It stands for, I think, cross-origin resource sharing, and it's a standard with just a couple of headers and things for AJAX requests, for XML HTTP requests to cross domains. Because when it went from its introduction, which actually Microsoft invented, we like to forget that Microsoft did one of the most important things for the internet. from the XML HTTP request introduction through around now, you could only make the request back to your own domain, and that was for a lot of its different security purposes and various XSS and CSERF protections and things like that. But the problem is that kind of limited what you could do. If you had to actually send a request cross-domain from within a page, you would have to do an iframe or some kind of weirdo hack. In my case, the Instapaper bookmarklet is sent via post, not GET. And the reason why is because I save a copy of the page's contents as it's viewed. I'm pretty sure I've mentioned this already.
Yeah.
The idea then is it just transparently gets past any kind of login restriction or anything like that. The idea is, if you can see it, if you are allowed to see something, you can save it to your Instapaper account. Simple as that. You don't have to type in all your passwords or anything stupid like that. So I have to send a copy of the page. So if you stick this at the end of a URL, just in a GET request, not only are you going to lose a lot of space due to URL encoding, but you're also going to run into a lot of limitations of how long URLs can be in various components in your stack. Maybe the browser that's launching it is going to impose a standard. Maybe your load balancer or caching proxy might impose a standard. Right. Apache certainly will. PHP even might. There's all these different things that will enforce different URL length restrictions, and you don't want to run into any of them. And I do what I can to try to shrink the size of what's being sent. But either way, it's still going to be a few kilobytes at least. Usually it's like 9K worth of data that I end up sending. And that's a lot for a URL to be 9,000 characters long. I know it's not the exact number for 9K. Sorry. So in the bookmarklet, what I've been doing so far is I create an iframe that then sends, it has a form inside that posts itself with a bunch of hidden values to the server for all the different variables that I need from the page. And this causes a couple problems. So one is that in some browsers, I think Firefox was the worst of them, that would add an entry to the history list. And so it would kind of break the back button's functionality. Like you'd hit back and nothing would happen.
Right.
And then you'd hit back again and then it would actually go to the page. In some versions of Firefox, it would break the back button completely because there was a bug where it would add the entry to the history list, but then that frame would disappear. So the frame that had the history entry no longer existed, but it would be trying to access it, and it would never pop it properly. That was annoying, but that's no longer the case. So there were lots of reasons why it would be very nice if I could move that action to an XML HTTP request instead of a hidden form element that's posting itself. So I was finally able to do that now with CORS. So now the bookmarklet does two things. It creates that form, and it attempts to submit it via CORS cross domain.
Hmm.
And if it fails, because the browser doesn't support CORS yet, thanks, IE. although the funny thing is, now doing this, it actually works in IE for the first time. I finally got it working, but that was not fun. If it fails, then it just submits the hidden form. This is also worth pointing out. I want this to be as small as possible. All this code needs to be very, very small. There's a spinner graphic as it's saving.
Yeah.
And I changed that to all JavaScript and CSS, which is
nice.
Awesome. And it doesn't work in IE, but I don't care.
Right.
I think IE people are now accustomed to things not looking.
Doesn't
well.
Work in any IE or just an older one?
Not even in 9, because it doesn't support the CSS transforms yet, as far as I know. Unless it might. I'm pretty sure it doesn't. I think it's just WebKit and Mozilla right now.
Okay.
Although I'm sure I'm going to get an email from the Opera people saying, we've supported that since 1992. Right. Anyway, Opera is, I said it in the chat, Opera is like the Simpsons did it of our industry. Opera did it 10 years ago. They've probably already made an Instapaper competitor that I didn't even know about because both of their users didn't tell me about it. I have this now form, but still making an iframe, and then you have to deal with cross frame restrictions. So even some browsers impose, especially IE, impose really weird stuff on what frames can do. And there's even a new XSS prevention thing in IE. I think 9 only and up. I don't think it's an 8, but in IE 9 there's an XSS thing that it took me forever to find any mention of this, but if you try to execute JavaScript in an iframe, you're probably going to have this problem. You're probably going to run into this somehow. And there's a special header if you do x-xss-protection0, that will turn this off on the page that's being loaded. It's crazy. Like they've put in all this crazy stuff, but turns out I have to do this giant pile of hacks for two reasons. A, because I have to post this data, and B, because it has to be in an iframe. And the reason it has to be in an iframe is for formatting purposes. Well, first of all, it's for the form. If I'm posting with a form, it has to be in a frame so it doesn't disrupt the page you're viewing. And then I can just remove it, and then the whole thing's done. But now that it's in an XML HTTP request for most browsers, I could theoretically just put it in a div or something and then just remove the div when it's done. But there's the issue of CSS being inherited. And this, I'm not really sure how to fix this. There was a proposal for HTML5 that I'm pretty sure either has been ignored or just abandoned or officially denied for a reset element. Like, you know, just like you have div and p, there'd be an element called reset. And inside of that element, CSS would not be applied. It would start over from nothing. Similar to, you know, iframes. That's the whole purpose of having the iframe is because inside of it, you control the formatting 100%. You know, outside, you could be on this page, they could be doing something crazy with their transforms or with all the different font settings. They could be declaring properties that you don't even know exist or properties that were created after you wrote this code. So to try to enforce your own CSS reset inside of an element manually is quite a big job that I certainly don't want to deal with. And I don't know if anybody has done that very well. I really, really wouldn't want to deal with it. And again, even for file size and for bandwidth, that's a lot of code to send all those CSS declarations to reset it back to what you want. So I think there's a need for something like that reset element. I don't really know if that's the right solution for it. But I mean, I'm sure every web developer has run into this problem where like you just want this element to not be affected by the page's CSS. You know, have it start over, have it be its own thing, totally independent. And yeah, right now the only way to do that is iframes, and that's frustrating. So anyway, yeah, I had a nice little web development refresher this week when I was doing all this work, but I'm actually really proud of the way it turned out. And there's another big improvement that I haven't done yet that I can do now. Just before, I've mentioned this I think before, there's no way to gzip compress the outbound request, as far as I know.
Right. That's a good question.
I was not able to find a way last time I looked. There might be one now. I'd love to hear about it if you know. Because I'll tell you what the bookmarklet does now. As far as I know, there's no way to gzip the outbound request. So when pages are served to you, the server almost always compresses them with gzip, usually deflate, and it's fantastic because it saves tons of bandwidth, like usually at least 75%. Of the bandwidth is saved. So it's fantastic. Everything loads faster, server saves money, everyone's happy. Well, what the bookmarklet does, by submitting a copy of the page you're viewing to my server, that has to send all that data back. So that's the in the request body, it's in the post body. So there's two problems with this. One is that that's not gzip compressed. The server doesn't get a compressed request, only it just sends compressed responses. So you're sending a bunch of uncompressed data, which is big. The other problem is that when it's in, if it's in just a form element that's just being posted, you're kind of stuck making it URL encode the whole thing, just like a multi-part form data format. So if you have any kind of binary data in there or anything that has a lot of non-A to Z characters, you're going to lose a lot to the overhead of the percent encoding. So your data might become three times bigger than what you expected it to be or started out as. So you have data that's encoded in a way that makes it huge. Then you have an uncompressed request being sent to the server. So, and a lot of these people are saving pages from mobile devices or even just from crappy home DSL connections that have much slower upstreams than downstreams. So there's all these problems with doing this. So what I've done so far is I found a JavaScript implementation of Deflate, which is a very hard thing to search for. like some guy had actually written Deflate in JavaScript, so which is awesome. And so I actually deflate the data myself in JavaScript before sending it. And the other thing I do is I base64 encode it. Because base64, because you know, deflate has all this binary output. And base64 will convert it to an alphabet that, for the most part, doesn't get URL encoded. So it won't have all that bloat added to it in the actual form transmission. It adds, I think, 30% or 33%. I think it adds a third or a quarter. I think it goes 3 to 4 or 2 to 3, one of those. Anyway, it adds some overhead to the format, a non-trivial amount. But when you're making an XML HTTP request, you can, like, you give the data manually. You know, right now everyone's using these frameworks that will submit the form for you dynamically. But for this, I needed everything to be small, so I just looked at the code myself and did my own little AJAX form submitter. It builds the format manually, so you don't have to send it as percent encoded values. You can send it whatever format you want, as long as your server can understand it. So what I think I'm going to try to do, I'm not sure if this is going to work yet, but I think I'm just going to try sending the binary. Deflate data in the request, and right. That way I can save the base64 overhead and save, you know, 25 or 33% of the size. That's an even bigger advantage of not having the hidden form being submitted. Anyway,
but do you see these are very interesting problems, because again, this I think sort of exemplifies the fact that you're not just building, you don't just have an iOS app. You don't just have a web app, and you don't even just have the combination of those two. You really do have a platform. And I think you're in a unique situation, because a lot of iOS developers, for example, and I know that we have developers of all kinds listening to this show, I would think, but you're really not only mixing disciplines, but you're getting into that whole category of building a full platform. It's like you have a platform and there are different components to that. There's the web side of it. There's the browser support side of it. There's the actual iOS side. And just in this show, you've already talked about two different things. You've talked about user interfaces with code on, you know, in iOS. And then here you're talking about browser idiosyncrasies.
Well, I think you have to. I think one of the reasons why the iPhone is so compelling, you know, why has this mattered when we've had PDAs forever? Why are apps on the iPhone important when apps for PDAs were always this really tiny market?
Right.
I think the big reason is that, you know, the version of Mealborn on my Palm Pilot in 1997 or so didn't need to talk to any servers. It couldn't really do much. Maybe it could have online play, but in reality, there were only three people who ever bought it probably, so that wouldn't work very well. With the iPhone, every single one of them had a data connection. Well, the iPod Touch then came out. But anyway, for the most part, most iOS devices are internet connected most of the time. And I can't back that up with anything. I would guess that's probably the case. But the fact is, the iPhone matters. Apps can be so important on it because it has that combination that we never had before of this thing that's always in our pocket and also data connection. You know, that this thing can access the internet and this can access web services. You know, if you look at all the apps that you use, besides games, although they can access the internet too, but games have always been okay. Look at the apps that you use that aren't games. How many of them are useful primarily or only because they talk to a web service? It's probably a lot of them. You can always have things like unit converters and things like that, but for the most part, things like Twitter apps, feed readers, any kind of social networking, these are all things that are useful because of the web services they talk to. And the app is just a local client for those things. I think that's really that's a very important thing to note, because if you want to be an app developer, unless you're going to go into one of those markets where there's no online component, which they do exist, but you know that they're limited, you have to know how to do web services, or you have to have one that you're talking to, or you have to be willing to make that jump. Like there are Twitter clients, and you know that's a whole category of things. But like there are Twitter clients that use Twitter, and that's why they're useful.
Right.
The ones that have added their own web services are even more useful. Like Echophone is a great example. Echophone added sync of your red positions. And it's never been my client of choice, but I really respect things like that because they're adding other web services to add value. So this is like you can sync all your red positions and they talk to the server for you and work all that out. TweetDeck does a ridiculous amount of things with server stuff. And these add a lot of value. Whereas if you're making a Twitter client that doesn't have its own web service, you're very limited in what you can do that's different from anyone else. You know, so and the same thing happens with web apps. With non-Twitter apps for the iPhone or iPad. You know, if you aren't adding a web service, you're gonna be very limited in what it can do. You know, you're gonna have to either talk to services directly, which are still using web services, or you're gonna have to work totally offline, which is limited, and you know, you can't really dynamically update things.
Right.
There's all sorts of limitations. So I think it's important to recognize that developing for iOS is not just about Objective-C and not just about Cocoa and not just about Interface Builder and Xcode. There's this whole world that it exists inside of. You know, this whole internet, this whole world that if your app finds a way to talk to that or is part of that, that's much more powerful than if it isn't. So I think you kind of have to know all the disciplines, or at least you have to have a working knowledge of a lot of them.
Yeah. Now, there's a story that came out. It actually came out, I think, about a week ago, but we didn't get to talk about it on the show. It's very important, I think, or it may be important. You may be able to say it's not important. And I don't want to because I know you have your list. I can't.
No, this is good. My list was kind of weak this week, so this is good.
All right. Well, before we do, I'll keep you in suspense because this is important. But before that, we want to thank our second sponsor, Worldview, created by Campaign Monitor. This is really cool. You need to check this out. This is a totally addictive take on email reporting. And the Campaign Monitor guys, basically, you send a newsletter. They show you on a map in real time whenever somebody opens it up, when they click on a link, or when they forward it to one of their friends. But get this. They'll also show you who is liking the email on Facebook, if it gets mentioned on Twitter. Again, they show this on a map the moment that it happens. It's very cool. It's like watching a movie. And here's the best part. It's free for every email campaign that you send. You can try this out as a demo. Again, it's free. Campaignmonitor.com/worldview, one word. And these guys just keep innovating. They've actually got something else that's really cool coming out. I don't know if I can talk about it yet, so I'm just going to defer to not being able to talk about it. But I don't want that to take away from Worldview, so check this out. These guys are doing really, really cool stuff. Campaignmonitor.com. Thank you. So here's the news. Reportedly, Apple has changed the App Store ranking algorithm. Did you hear about this?
Oh, yeah. I wrote a quick thing about this. Yeah. I haven't heard anything more about it since then.
So for the people who haven't read your post on it, I'll make sure that's in the show notes. By the way,
it's a pretty content free post.
Well, you can read the show notes by just going to 5by5.tv/build/analyze/next. It will take you to the most recent show or the latest upcoming show, that kind of thing. But in any case, according to Inside Mobile Apps, which is some website, they're saying that less importance is now being given to the number of downloads of an app when they're trying to determine where it appears in the App Store. So before, the algorithm was how many downloads. Now, apparently, Flurry, who's providing, this is an analytics provider, they said that they've seen changes in the top free app category rankings after maybe this change was made. And they're saying one of the big changes at the Facebook app, which was down at like 20th, all of a sudden now it's at the top. And that means that they're perhaps using usage, active usage, to rank apps. Now, first of all...
Yeah, that's a big question.
Yeah, I mean, is that... What do you make of all of this?
Well, what we know... is and it isn't just them reporting it. Everything, every service that tracks ranks noticed this.
Yeah.
Like I use AppViz and they posted I use AppFigures for that, and they posted a thing on their little forum on inside the site. Before this was being widely reported, just saying, hey, we just noticed about 12 hours ago a massive change in the free app rankings.
Right.
And they didn't know why yet, but they said something big has changed. So. What we know definitely is pretty much just that. We know that there was a big change made. It seems to have only affected free apps. And a lot of apps that were getting rankings through ways that might have been unscrupulous saw their rankings fall. And a lot of apps that were more normal saw their rankings slightly rise. So... at the moment, I don't have a free app in the store, so I really can't tell what it did from any firsthand knowledge. Right. But
this could have big repercussions. I mean, how do they track this stuff? So does that mean that every time you launch an app, that it's phoning home or it's sending it when it syncs? How do they know how often you're doing this?
Right. That's a big question. So if they're using time spent in the app as a metric, they would have to be doing some kind of creepy privacy thing like that. I don't think that's likely. Now they do collect crash reports and make those available to developers if you opt in, which I think most people do. There's a box somewhere that I think it's built into something else or something. Yeah. I think most people opt into that, but so they do have data somewhat on how much use it's getting, especially if it's an app that crashes a lot.
Yeah,
and most apps do crash a lot. So what
do they?
In the aggregate, sure. So anyway, they know somewhat without collecting data on every launch. They have some idea of that sort of thing. But I'm not sure. I really don't think they would send logs of how often an app was launched. I don't see that happening at all. There are a lot of metrics that they have at their disposal without adding anything creepy like that, that they can definitely be using to filter these things out. So one thing might just be, they might have just beefed up their fraud and rank gaming detection or the staff that does that,
right,
in such a way that they just kicked out or delisted or devalued a bunch of really big abusers. So that alone could have done it. Like, there are a lot of these companies that have like the game cheats guides and stuff like that, all these kind of scammy, crappy things that I don't even think should be in the App Store, but there's a lot of those things. And if Apple were to like delist or deprioritize even as few as like 20 vendors, that could represent hundreds of these apps, because that's what they do. They make tons of them, and that alone could have caused this change. Just delisting a bunch of really big names, and there were reports of a lot of these like weirdo games and stuff doing crazy things like a game would give you more in-game credits if you installed a company's other apps. So that way they would have like one popular thing, and then people who want credits in that game would then go install their other apps and boost their rankings. So then you can kind of have more... It was just a way to artificially improve your ranking.
Hmm.
And that's... Any effort to game the rankings is against Apple's policies, but they don't seem to enforce it that much because it's a very gray area and a lot of times it's hard to find. So from what I know, they definitely are cracking down on that sort of thing, and that seemed to correlate to when this happened. But I I don't really know for sure what they're doing, and no one does. I haven't heard a thing about it since that day when all these stories came out all saying the same thing, which is everyone noticed a difference, and it seems like it's not just downloads anymore, but no one really knows what it is.
Hmm.
And I even said in my post, if anyone knows anything more, I'd love to hear it, and no one responded. But that's, I mean, that isn't a big surprise. But I really don't think that we're going to ever know what's going on there. But it wouldn't surprise me if it's not something really creepy, like they record every time you launch an app. But, you know, I doubt that's the case. It could be a lot of things. It could be like the rate. Well, I guess it wouldn't be the rate of refunds because that's their free apps only.
Right.
But, you know, there are so many different things they could look at. They could look at the rate of installations. They could look at the source of installations. That's a big one. Like if an app gets most of its downloads through other apps permalinking into the iTunes store, as opposed to people browsing the iTunes store and looking and doing searches or looking at the rankings, then finding them that way, that's an indication that there's a lot of external demand, possibly false demand. I mean, there are legitimate cases for that, but most of the App Store purchases go through the App Store itself, people browsing and searching. So if you're getting a lot of inbound sales from like permalink views that don't come from those things, you know, we don't have that data, but Apple has that data. They know where people came from when they bought something. So they could be using things like that. So again, I don't think there's much to this story. It just seems like they deployed a new algorithm that considers something that doesn't really seem to be penalizing legitimate apps. In fact, in many cases, it's helping them. And it seems like it mostly penalized a bunch of abusive apps.
Right.
So really, no harm done. In fact, I wish they would do more of that. You can look at the App Store and you can see, like I found last week, I tweeted about it. At the time, I was considering spinning off the Instapaper Dictionary into its own app, just because I have this awesome compressed Wiktionary file that I can give you most of the value of a dictionary in about 10 megs, whereas almost all the other ones are like 50, 100, 200, 300 megs. They're huge. So I could give you most of the value in a very small file size. And I thought, I've already done most of the work for this. Is there a market for like a 99-cent app that would just be a dictionary with just this little file and then, you know, link you to the full page if you wanted more info? So I was looking at the reference category, which is where dictionaries hang out. And the reference category is all like game cheat guides. That's all it is. Like it's a disaster zone. Mm. And the number one app in reference at the time was Plants vs. Zombies 2 guide. And everyone was searching the App Store for Plants vs. Zombies 2. And they saw,
I was going to say, is there Plants vs. Zombies 2 yet?
I think it was announced, but I don't think it's out yet.
Oh, man.
So everyone was searching for it. They found that, and it was like $2, and like the graphic, the icon kind of looked like Plants vs. Zombies, and the screenshots were all different screenshots of like different zombies and other like characters in the game. and it was like a guide to this, and it, you know, total scam, obviously with intent to defraud people. Like this was not an accident. This is clear intent to defraud and to abuse trademark.
Right.
Somehow that got into the store, and you know, it seems like, you know, first of all, it's frustrating to me as a developer to see so much crap in the store, stuff that should not be rejected. And then you hear like all the high profile rejections of apps that we think should be allowed in, but then Apple finds some weirdo rule where they're not allowed in. So that's, you know, that's like, it's frustrating, but you know, it's funny. Like if you look at that app, you read the reviews, every single review is like one star, full of exclamation points. This is a scam. I can't believe this. And some of them are really sad. Like, I'm 7 years old and I just spent my only iTunes credit on this game. And my parents are upset with me for spending this $2. It's sad. I mean, it's really funny, to be honest. But browse the reference category in the App Store for a good laugh. But it's, so there's so much crap in the App Store. I would love if Apple did anything to be more aggressive about getting it out of there. That's why I fully support app review. Because if you look at the Android storefronts, they're far worse.
Yeah, oh, it's way worse. What you're describing there is by far the majority of the kind of apps that you'll see in there. Terrible. Unusable, really.
Yeah. it's rough. And even like I'm, and you know, from being an Android user, I don't really know that much, but I've heard even if there is a popular app, if you search for it, you know, if you search the iTunes store for Angry Birds, you know, on your phone, on your iPad, so you don't have like the full browser and everything, you have, you know, the iTunes store and you search for Angry Birds, and probably, I don't know for sure, I haven't tried it today, but probably the first result is Angry Birds, the real game, you know, exactly what you're looking for. And then probably the rest of them are all guides to Angry Birds, cheats for Angry Birds, all this stupid garbage. On the Android store, it's actually, from what I understand, in many cases, it's actually difficult to find the right one.
The real one, and you're not sure. And even their names will be similar.
Right. Like, it's much more blatant and problematic. I mean, the iTunes store is pretty bad in that regard, and they need to do a lot to fix that. But the Android store is far worse. I mean, like, you can't even find the official app for what you're looking for. So I definitely support app review, and I think it wouldn't hurt to have more app review just in the right places. You know, I don't think we need any more resources devoted to making sure no one competes with Apple's apps, for instance. you know, like making sure that like some developer in the Mac App Store can't release his launcher because it conflicts with a feature that Line's going to have. You know, that's bad.
Yeah.
But yet you have all this, you know, trademark squatting fraudulent crap sitting in the reference category, guides to games and cheats and all this stupid stuff. So I wouldn't mind having more review. This is actually worth a quick point too. There was a story out this week, just I think today or yesterday, about the Barnes & Noble Nook Color,
right?
Which is, it's like a $250 Android tablet that so far has only been used to be a book reader. They got a software update that now gives it its own app store. So now developers are going to rush in and flood the Barnes & Noble Nook Color with apps so that everyone could have their $250 tablet full of wonderful apps from developers who are going to rush in there because there's the store that exists. There's a lot of app stores. Every single new device has an app store. I'm really getting app store fatigue at this point. but it's worth thinking about, you know, as a developer. I'm sorry, I've talked about this before. This whole show might be just repeats that I forgot were repeats. But, you know, when should you enter a new app store? And, you know, when a new device comes out, when should you develop for it? Should you develop for it at all? And we've touched on this in a few different ways. So I've said in the past, it's kind of like a marriage. Like, you kind of marry the platform when you make a product for it, and you have to really be confident in its present and future states and health to do that. But I just think the whole, like, why would developers rush to a storefront and do a lot of work and take on a non-trivial support burden for a brand new empty platform that to date has sold either zero units, as in these new tablets that come out starting from nothing,
right?
Or in the case of something like the Nook Color, that have sold relatively few units, not really enough to matter. Like, you're probably never going to reach much of an audience. And again, one reason to do that is because you use these platforms and you want your own app to use. That's fine. But if you're trying to make a business out of it, you got to figure where are the customers here? And there's nothing wrong with doing the Apple approach of you pick the profitable market and only serve that and don't serve the mass. You know, it's okay to ignore Windows PCs, even though they're 90% of PCs out there. It's totally okay to ignore them because the Mac market is big enough, it's enough people, and it's very profitable. Similar, in my opinion, it's okay to only develop mobile apps for iPhone, even though Android exists, BlackBerry, Windows Mobile, all these things exist. Sorry, Symbian people, that exists too. And, you know, iOS is only, what, like 20% or something of the whole smartphone market? Something in that ballpark. And so you can say, well, why only serve 20% of the users? Well, again, it's enough because the iOS market is still, it's a lot of people, and it's a very profitable market. But like something like the Nook Color or the new BlackBerry Playbook, these new platforms that start out with very, very few users, like, what's the business case of going through the trouble of making an app for those? I just don't get it. I really don't get it. And it seems like the hardware manufacturers or the platform vendors in these cases are very optimistic. They are assuming for some reason, or at least maybe they're just hoping, that developers are going to just rush in because it's a new – like it's as if Apple made the App Store and everyone rushed to it, not because tons of people had iPhones, not because all the developers had iPhones, and not because you could make a lot of money there.
Right.
But because, oh, it's a place where software can run. So let's go put some there. Let's invest lots of time and money into it. And that's how the other vendors are viewing this, as like, if we make an app store, they will come. And that doesn't really happen. And I think, you know, you can ask Motorola how well the Zoom targeted software is doing. Are they still selling that?
Yes.
They're still selling the Zoom?
Yeah.
They didn't discontinue it yet?
No.
Okay. I'm really, and this is going to be a big problem with all these new tablets. This generally happens whenever there's a new technology market, whenever there's some new computing device or a new type of computer where people buy. Like this happens in probably all industries, where some new market opens up, and everyone rushes in to just fragment the hell out of it. And you know, how many tablet platforms are there going to be that have a large volume of native software written for them? You know, maybe if it's anything like the desktop computer market, that number is going to be between 1 and 3.
Right.
And in a lot of ways it isn't, but in general, in the native software business, that's a lot of work. Like I can't port any of my code between iOS and Android. They're whole different platforms.
Right.
If I made an Android client, I had to start over from zero, which I really have no motivation or intent to do. So, you know, how many of these tablets do you think are going to have reasonably sized markets where it's worth any of us caring? And then furthermore, isn't that going to be a pretty big problem for their sales? Like this is a big chicken and egg problem. No one's going to develop for the Zoom tablet until there's enough of a market for Zooms that it's worth developing for it.
Right.
But who's going to buy the Zoom when there's no software for it?
Yeah.
Besides geeks and gadget bloggers. And that's a fine market, but it's not very big. You know, you can say the exact same thing about all these tablets. You can say the same thing about the webOS, iPad that's not an iPad, the touchpad, that's right. I still can't get over that stupid name and the stupid ripoff job they did with the hardware. So, yeah, like, who's going to buy that when there's no software? Who's going to buy the playbook? It doesn't even have an email client. There's like all these kind of half-baked tablet launches, and the new Lenovo thing is going to run its own Android thing, and now the Barnes & Noble Nook Color that now has its own app store that isn't the Google Android Marketplace, which might be a good thing not to have that. And then I assume Amazon's going to launch a tablet at some point very similar to the Nook Color. It's going to be cheap and, you know, 7-inch and have the Amazon app store with no space, you know, only have that. So there's going to be all these different platforms, but who's going to buy these things in enough volume to make any of them dominant when the iPad exists, which is already to massive volume and already dominant and in many ways better and or cheaper than most of its competitors? I don't see it happening. The iPad has such a massive lead now. I don't see how someone's going to catch up. Amazon has a chance. I don't think it's a very good chance even, but I think Amazon has a chance to be the Windows Phone 7 of the tablet market. And by that I mean the alternative that's pretty good, that people kind of like, but it's never going to get massive market share. I think that's what Amazon's going to give us in the tablet market. Barnes & Noble, I think, has a lot of problems. They've shown in the last few years that they have a lot of internal problems, a lot of finance problems. Their stores are a mess, and there's all sorts of issues that they're having. I don't think they're going to be a serious competitor for long. Well, they aren't one now, but even compared to the Kindle, I don't think they're going to be a serious competitor for long. And RIM, I think, is in a pretty bad downward spiral. The release of the playbook can show that in many ways. It shows that there's a lot of seriously wrong things in that company. And you know, HP, they're gonna do their best. I think it's gonna be very similar to WebOS on phones, which is, you know, like the Palm Pre, the whole series. People like it, but it's such a small universe. It's like BOS. or BIOS, however you're supposed to pronounce that.
BOS, yeah.
That's, yeah, it's like that. Like, people liked BOS, but like...
Loved it.
10 people loved it.
You know? There were not like, there were not many of us.
Right. It was good, but it just wasn't, like, it wasn't enough to overcome what was already there. I think the iPad has, I mean, and you know, these markets move fast now. The smartphone market exploded with the iPhone and around that time. The iPad defined the entire tablet market, or redefined it. These things move fast now. I think if you launch a new tablet in 2012, say, or I guess in 2011, I guess people will still try to launch these things this year, even if they're not done, like the RIM Playbook. But you know, if you launch a tablet in 2011, you're entering a market that the iPad has already kicked butt in and has already dominated in. It'd be kind of like releasing a new desktop OS in 2005. You know, like, this is already an established market. You're probably not going to do very well. And the fact is, Apple killed it with the iPad. The first version was so good, and it was building off of the iPhone infrastructure and an ecosystem, which was, you know, it was already established in that way. It was so good on launch that I think the normal period of a bunch of competitors being able to happily coexist with decent market share until it settles down into two or three, I think we've skipped that already. I think we're already past that point. Like, the whole, like, the 80s and early 90s in personal computers, I think that all, that was, we skipped that with tablets, because computers in the 80s and early 90s sucked.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of room for other competitors to come in still and to kind of fight Microsoft on some fronts. You know, Apple was there. Even OS 2 still existed at that point. Like, there were all sorts of different alternatives there. And, you know, Microsoft mostly won pretty quickly. But, you know, there was still a lot of time for experimentation and time for competitors. I think with the tablet market, we're past that time. I don't even know if it existed. I think because the iPad was just so good. And there's so many other factors now that matter. There's the ecosystem of apps, there's the content storefronts, there's all these different factors that matter that didn't matter in the computer wars in the 80s and 90s. I just don't see anyone catching up with Apple's lead in this market anytime in the near future, even in the far future. I just don't see that happening. What do you think? Do you think there's a future in other tablets?
It's something I've been thinking about a lot, Marco. I really think you nailed it. I mean, so much of it was the fact that when the iPhone came out, it was this great device. It was a game-changing device. It had no store. But there were enough people who were saying, man, this is the device to have. This is so cool. And they got it, and then you come out with this whole ecosystem underneath it, and now it's a cool device with, even if it doesn't have very many apps, it's got a great browser and a great email client. And for a lot of people, that's mainly what they use it for. They don't even use half the apps. Then you come out with these amazing apps for it. You've got this great developer environment. You've got this great consumer marketplace. How do you ever catch up to that? How do you ever compete? I mean, maybe it's naive to say that. Maybe there's going to be something, but yeah, I don't think that Android is in a position, or Android devices in general are going to be in any position other than, I don't even want to say playing catch up. I feel like they are in a second-class situation where, well, for whatever reason, my device is an Android device, and yeah, there's a store, and that's where I go to get stuff, and maybe there's people who are making a killing in those stores. I think there are. But it never strikes me as being the desirable place to be. It seems like the people who are having the most fun, maybe not necessarily making the most money, but having the most fun, enjoying what they do, and really engaged in that community, they seem to be focusing in the iOS community, don't they? So I don't.
Yeah, as far as I can tell.
I mean, and it's like you said, it's that catch 22 situation. I mean, you've got Fred Wilson on the one hand who's saying, "Well, no, everybody should be investing in Android. This is the future." Maybe he's right. Maybe Android will have and will continue to have the numbers, and eventually the whole thing coalesces down into, yeah, there's a store and people are in there and making money. Is that how you determine who wins? I mean, is the store that's making the most sales the one that wins, or is it the one with the best stuff?
It's a good question. I mean, I mean, Android is that's a whole thing. I mean, that's like I think Android, just like every other facet of Android that isn't very good today, its relevance is always about to get really big. It's mm-hmm. always going to be really big in the next version.
Mm-hmm.
back to the topic. I really don't. I mean, I'm pretty bad at future predictions. I'm especially bad at saying X or Y will never happen. I'm always wrong with that.
Mm.
But I have a hard time seeing how any of these competitors are going to provide meaningful competition to the iPad in the next era. Maybe that's 5 years. Maybe that's 3 years. Maybe it's more. I don't know. But this market, you know, while it is very young, so it's dangerous to make these kind of predictions. It is a very, very young market, but it is so solidified, and it's not, you know, because of all the other factors of the ecosystems, the content stores, all this other stuff. It's kind of not as young as it seems.
Mm.
You know, like the reason why the iPad avoided the chicken and egg problem completely. For I think two reasons, you know, because you can say on day one of the iPad, the user base was zero. So why did developers make apps for it? And you know, in reality, the user base was it was a sure thing. First of all, there was the massive iPhone user base by that point, and everyone knew when they got their iPads, they could run their iPhone apps on them.
Right.
So the customer side was kind of fixed in advance for that. And the developer side, we were all so confident that Apple would sell a lot of these things that we all just assumed there was going to be a big user base and developed accordingly. And we were right. And we were right more quickly than anyone thought we would be. But that's really, you know, that's why the iPad avoided that. I don't really see that same momentum happening behind any other platform. Even Android, you can say, well, you know, the tablets can run the phone apps, but turns out no one likes that. And maybe now with the iPad, we know that we don't like that. Maybe we just didn't know that before.
Mm-hmm.
But it stopped mattering on the iPad so quickly because everyone made native apps because they sold so well. And yeah, with Android, I don't see any tablet selling well enough to overcome that for a long time. The only area I think somebody could attack the iPad from is the 7-inch area. The 7-inch really inexpensive tablet market.
You mean come out with something that's 7-inch screen that we know at least right now Apple has no intentions of making an iPad device in that size that they've
right.
they've admitted to. Come in and create such a great experience in that form factor that people who just say the iPad is too darn big, and you hear that complaint when? Never. People saying the iPad is too big. I wish I had the 7-inch device instead. We're going to give you something in that 7-inch space that is going to be great and would make you say, I don't care that there are no apps for it and that the app stores are terrible and the hardware isn't as good and et cetera. And people are going to go for that?
I mean, it's possible.
How cheap would it have to be?
This is what I think Amazon's going to do. I wrote all this, so I don't want to repeat the whole thing. But I think Amazon is going to try it from this angle. I think it would definitely make the most sense for them to do it from this angle. Mm-hmm. Which I think, in Amazon's case, you know, there's a lot of factors in the iPad's success that a lot of people don't talk about or don't think about very much. One of the big ones is the retail stores that you can walk into any Apple store and buy an iPad, and increasingly a lot of other stores. How many stores sell the Motorola Zoom?
Right.
You know, I think Best Buy does, but I think they're the only major retailer who does. And even then, you know, the presentation in the store is pretty bad. It's kind of shoved with the laptops, and you know, so Apple has this massive retail presence, which is great for so many reasons. You know, it's great because you can go and get one anywhere. It's great because you can go in and get support for it from the same place you got it from, or from any other Apple store that you can find. There's accessories for it available everywhere. It's bit, you know, there's so many advantages that Apple has from having the whole retail arm. So that's a big factor, and I don't think any Android tablet is ever going to overcome the fragmentation enough to have that same kind of big presence. But Amazon does. One of the biggest reasons why the Kindle has sold so well is because it's been on the front page of Amazon's website, the biggest retailer in the world probably, or well, not probably not, but one of the biggest retailers in the world, probably at least the biggest online retailer. It's been on the front page of their website being promoted like crazy for years.
Mm.
Every single day it was on that front page. I mean, you couldn't be an Amazon customer and not know about this thing.
Yeah.
So if they wanted to mount a big attack on the iPad with their own 7-inch cheaper tablet, they very easily could take advantage of that and do the same thing, promote the hell out of it on the front page.
Right.
And just make it so that you can't shop at Amazon without knowing about this thing. And you're gonna be reminded of it every single time you come to the site. Anytime they give you a recommended gifts list, they're gonna suggest that. Like, and they're never gonna mention the iPad again. Like they're definitely gonna try something like that if they would enter this market. And they also have the advantage of their new ad thing they're doing with the Kindle with special offers.
Right, yeah.
Where you can save, is it 25? Yeah, you save $25 on the price of your Kindle by accepting ads on it. And I think that's, as I wrote in my blog post, I think that's kind of a test. And I think if they were going to build a tablet to compete with the iPad and make it a 7-inch tablet and possibly make it a slower processor and things like that, they could probably do a $200 tablet pretty easily. Maybe even less, but probably not. But $200 tablet, maybe subsidized by ads, maybe a $300 one without ads. I mean, the Note Color is only $250, and it's very low-end hardware. You know, it's very slow processor and everything, but that's still most of the hardware you need for a tablet for $250. That's not bad. So if Amazon makes something similar and pushes it like crazy, and they have all their content stores, not only the Kindle bookstore, they have video source, they have audio, like they have a way to get content on it, something that Android and everyone else seems to ignore, which is like if you buy one of these things for your mom and she's going on a plane and wants to watch a movie,
mm-hmm.
what does she have to do to get a movie on it? You know? Like Android is like, well, you can rip it with Handbrake and transfer or download it from a BitTorrent site.
Right.
There's very few good options there. On the iPad, it's like, oh, you open up the iTunes store right on the iPad, and they have deals, and everything's legal and easy. So Amazon is one of the only people who has that same kind of thing, or at least they could conceivably build it, where they already have a lot of the deals in place with the content providers, they have the storefront, they have all the payment processing stuff on the back end. So I think if meaningful competition exists, it's going to be from Amazon, for meaningful competition to the iPad. But even that, they couldn't attack it head on. I think if they made a $500 10-inch Kindle Color or Kindle tablet or something, and so it was basically just like the iPad, same price, same size, same everything, it would sell reasonably, but not well. And I don't think it would be significant competition. But if they position themselves as, look, you don't need to spend $500 on a tablet. You can just spend $200 on a tablet. Heck, you can have both. And then slowly realize you don't use your iPad anymore if you're crazy. There's all sorts of things they could do like that where they can enter a whole segment of the market that Apple seems to be disinterested in and possibly make it a more important segment than Apple wants it to be. That's how you attack a really dominant player. You know, you don't attack them head on. You kind of attack a nearby market that makes theirs seem less important or old or somehow unnecessary. So people are saying, I don't want to spend $500 on a tablet. Give them a $200 option. Sell it like crazy in your discount retailer. You know, get a deal with Sam's Clubs. Get it sold there. All that stuff. That's a way to attack them head on. Or, I mean, not head on. That's a way to attack the iPad that actually has a chance of winning. But something like the Zoom, where it's just another 10-inch tablet. It's 10-inch, right, the Zoom?
I think that the Zoom is 10, but which is the one that is 7?
The BlackBerry one's 7. The TouchPad, I think, is 10.
TouchPad
also
is the one, yeah.
That's 10.
You're right. It is 10.
TouchPad is basically the iPad 1 with an HP badge on the top. It's like identical.
And not iOS.
Totally shameless.
OS. Yeah.
And of course, yeah, not iOS. I'm curious to know if they're going to redo the design a bit now that the iPad 2 came out and made the touchpad look old by comparison. Anyway, so yeah, I don't see another way to attack the iPad. But that's probably...
Well, maybe Amazon's listening to the show.
Yeah, the whole company's listening.
We'll have to see.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting. At least things are changing.
Totally. And I definitely think that Apple does best for both itself and for consumers when it has competition.
Absolutely.
It's not good for them not to have competition.
I mean, even when there is no competition, and that's not often, but even when there's minimal competition, they're still innovating. But when there's real competition out there, when they actually, I don't think Apple's in a position where they feel scared or threatened, but they certainly pay attention to what's out there. And I think it absolutely motivates them to try to be more, to make more magic.
Right.
And that's good. It's very good for us.
Yeah. When Apple is complacent, they do things like iAds.
Right.
And when they feel threatened, they do really good things, really innovative things. I'm really, really curious to see what's in store for iOS 5. I cannot wait. I'm hoping WWDC shows us. It actually might not. It might be too early, but we'll see. I cannot wait for that. Because this is going to be a major OS release during which Apple has had a lot of competition. So I can't wait to see what they do. Like this is the environment that causes Apple to give us the best output and the best innovation. Like when they have this level of competition, they're not losing,
right,
but they're dangerously close in the cell phone mm-hmm. market to losing losing a lot to Android. Like I can't wait.
So tell me something. You headed out in a day or two here is it tomorrow or later this week? You're going to go wait in line for a white iPhone?
No, I that's.
But you were in line for the white one.
That's nice for the Dan Benjamin character.
But you're not going out to get the white. I figured you'd get with the white one.
No, you know now. By the way, I discovered I had my mom here the other day, and she has a Verizon phone, and it just kept dropping every call in my house. Verizon and AT&T are both kind of mediocre in the area that I live in, Westchester.
Yeah,
but I think AT&T is actually better.
Wow.
So all this time I've been planning to replace my iPhone, my AT&T iPhone, and my Verizon MiFi.
Maybe not.
With just a Verizon iPhone with tethering. And I think I might not be able to do that because Verizon is so bad in my house.
See, I've never been in anywhere in or near New York City with a Verizon phone, but I've been in lots of other places with one, some pre-iPhone days and some post, and I've never had a problem with it. But it'll be interesting. You know, you listen to what John Gruber's saying. He has much better luck in his very metropolitan area with Verizon, but you know, if you spend most of your time in that location and outside of New York, you got to be careful.
Well, I have the Verizon iPad. It does fantastically in Manhattan. Like when I bring it to Manhattan to go to a meeting or something, it does great, much better than AT&T did. But like on the train and in my house, AT&T is actually a little bit better, and that's a little scary to me.
Yeah.
So now, yeah, that's not good. So I don't know what to do. Because AT&T is not – I really don't want to keep it. I've always found that Verizon has not done nearly as well indoors as I wanted it to. Have you found it to be the case? Like outside, like in most places,
Verizon's
fine.
I found that
fine.
To be the case for every – for AT&T and Verizon and any other phone I've ever used.
I've never had a problem with AT&T in a house or in an apartment. But Verizon I've found more frequently than not, even like – like in a grocery store, like I wanted to go, you know, check something on the internet or look up an ingredient or something, and then I'll find there's on Verizon there's no coverage, and on AT&T it's usable.
See, I found actually now that I think about it, that was one of the reasons we switched to Verizon in the first place, was because any time that I was in a store or in a you know, like take the grocery store for example, I'm not talking about like the little corner store that just sells three things like you have there. I'm talking about one of these terrible suburban giant, you know, warehouses with rows and rows, you know, like
we have those too. I live in the place with trees.
Okay, so you've been in those, and we would go in there, and it's not like it would ring and the call would drop. It just with AT&T, it just wouldn't ring. Just no call would happen. I'd walk outside, and as soon as I get outside, you have five voicemails. Well, how did I get five calls?
See, that happened to me on Verizon all the time back before the iPhone. I just think neither carrier.
No carrier is
great.
Yeah.
I think we have.
Isn't that amazing though? That in 2011, Marco, that there are no great carriers, at least in the United States. Maybe the Europe. They could submerge their phone in cement and sink it beneath the ocean, and it'll climb out and, you know, hop in their pocket and ring for them. But we don't have that here in the States.
Yeah, it's crazy.
All of them are horrible.
We don't have it like in cities, but we have it at, like, I was hiking last summer. I was on top of a mountain in Vermont in the middle of nowhere, and I had like 3 bars of AT&T service and was able to look up stuff on the internet.
It's funny.
It's crazy. Yeah. So anyway, I think we've run long enough today.
Yeah, yeah. Well, all right. So we will be back though next week, Monday, at 2 p.m. Eastern time. Is that right? Do I have that right?
Yeah, 2 p.m. Eastern.
Sounds right.
And we, you know, I don't think you have to say Eastern, because, like, come on, where else is there?
Pretty soon I will have to, because I'll be in Central.
Oh yeah.
I'll be in Central in a month or so.
That's gonna suck.
For who? For the Eastern time people? When I change all the times to match my new schedule?
Oh man, that's gonna be terrible.
Who will that suck for?
You're always gonna have to do the translation in your head from, like, when someone tells you what time something's gonna happen, you're gonna be screwed, because you're always gonna have to, like, subtract one. You're gonna forget so often.
No, I do it. I still do it right now.
Here's a question: So you're moving to Austin, right?
That is correct.
Is Austin one of the options in the time zone dropdowns in computers?
Oh, let's look.
Launching system preferences. And I always, Ohio never was. I was always very happy after moving to New York that, like, now I live somewhere that's so important that it's a time zone option.
You were in Ohio before that?
Yeah, which is, it's a nice place to be, but, you know, once, if you don't have any people there, it's not really any reason to go there.
I'm looking right now.
Yeah, I bet Austin might be. I'm
pretty sure it's going to be Dallas.
Probably.
Even though Austin is the capital. Let's see what we've got here. Hold on. No Austin. Looking to see what we have. Do we have a Dallas? What if I start typing? No Houston. So let's just start typing Austin.
Well, all of, yeah, Texas, I mean, it's
in
time, right?
It's in the dropdown. It's in the dropdown, but I don't know. I'd need to go look at the more, you know, other computers, not the date and time, because date and time just finds anything you type into it.
Right. That's no fun.
But, you know, usually, like, when you're watching TV, it'll say at 8 p.m., 7 p.m. Central. You know, it's that kind of thing. And they don't even bother to mention the West Coast time, because the West Coast time has its own separate programming.
Right.
I won't be that far. Well, anyway, listen, we want to say thanks to our two sponsors. Please do check these guys out. People don't seem to realize this, but the sponsors support the show, and without them, we wouldn't be here.
People don't realize that?
They don't. They really don't. They fast forward through them, and it breaks my heart.
That's terrible.
So you got to go to blog.intuit.com or go to the iTunes App Store and search for Intuit Blog. This is a very cool blog. I read this thing all the time, and not just because they interviewed me, by the way. But it was a good interview over there. But I mean, you know, they explain things like how to start up a business, how to maintain work-life balance. Good stuff in there. Go check them out. Also check out campaignmonitor.com/worldview. And you can check out Marco's blog, marco.org.
I gotta watch Moonraker.
Yeah, you better, we only got a day or two. That's a movie. Yeah. Don't worry. You won't have, you won't need to watch that twice.
Okay. By the way, I thought Tiff and I both agreed that the last one, The Spy Who Loved Me, that was not a good movie.
Oh, I love that.
I don't know what you're thinking.
Love that one.
That's for a different show.
Maybe it's a generational thing.
It was so long. Just boring. Yeah, and I don't like
Brace yourself for Moonraker.
Oh, good.
All right, everybody. We'll see you next week. Thanks for tuning in.
See you later.